Welcome to Worst Year Ever, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
Hello, welcome back to the worst year ever.
Hello.
Continued into this one.
Yeah, because the year is not. Well, you know what? Let's not be unreasonable. Things are better in that this time last year, everything was shut down from a plague and there was no end in sight. And now there is a vaccine. And we might even get it out fast enough to avoid states like Florida and South Carolina spreading the South African variant of the virus that is vaccine resistant. Like, fingers crossed.
There is some hope for some things at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Great.
But that's the name of the show, and we're sticking with it.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking, I mean,
what else happened?
Well, a lot of things have happened. I guess it would be fair to say that mass shooting season has come back since things are opening up.
Back to normal.
Back to normal. As expected. And of course, I mean, just like a week after we talked to Christopher Wong about anti-Asian racism, there was the mass shooting in Atlanta. So we've got a couple of guests to talk about that. And it's a rough conversation. And I think there's a lot of good historical context. It's very interesting. I think you'll find it valuable. It's tough. So why don't we, before we go into that, let's each talk about something good that happened to us in the last week, just to, I don't know, a little palate cleanser.
Oh, I don't know. First thing comes to mind is I saw that video from the dog show of Gabby winning.
Gabby kicking ass.
Guys, just go to my Twitter and I retweeted it. That's the first nice thing that I could think of. Is it super cute? Does that count as something nice to share right now?
Yeah,
I think
it'll
bring a smile to your face.
Yes, absolutely.
It's really cute. Gabby did good.
We should, when we spend so much time digging into all of the horrible things people do, we should celebrate the one good thing our species has accomplished, which is dogs.
Yes. Yeah. They're the best.
Yeah, they're completely unproblematic good. And
victory. Victory on dogs.
Yeah. Victory. The war against not having dogs has been won conclusively.
I don't know. Tell that to PETA, but that's a topic for another time.
I think dogs would argue with PETA on that point.
I think so.
I'd watch that debate.
Cody, what about you?
Playing music a lot. That's fun. Did a lot of yard work yesterday, which was satisfying.
Oh, good. Yeah, I do enjoy
that. Yeah,
I'm gearing up for gardening season again. I just planted some potatoes, and I'm looking forward to plant more. I'm going to grow a fuckload of potatoes. Good
nice
time to be doing it. Food prices are going to skyrocket this year. The price of corn futures has just leapt enormously, and that means that meat is going to soar in price in the very near future.
Meat or mead?
Mead. Both. Mead prices are more reliant upon bumblebee futures.
And Renaissance fair season.
Absolutely.
The prices are going to skyrocket.
Really, what you want to look at is the sale of drinking horns. The more drinking horns are out in the public, the more expensive mead is going to be.
Well, I'm assuming with reopening, there's going to be more. So
I
could go for a Ren fair. I could go for literally anything where I'm around people without masks.
Outside with people,
I've shared this on shows. I think definitely on my Twitter. My next door neighbor works at the Renaissance Fair and as a performer, and since the beginning of the pandemic, has made ends meet by doing several live streams a week, every week. In the evening, you know, doing covers of songs, but like interjecting jokes like round, round, get around, I get around, she's fast, you know. I'm going to miss it. I'm going to have to go to the Renaissance Fair, which I will want to do. But, you know, sometimes you want to hang out in the backyard.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's fun. I would actually plug, people have asked me to share his Patreon, but I can't do that because that's a safety concern for me.
Oh,
yeah, personally, as my next door neighbor. Yeah, but he's
very
I don't mean
fair.
To make fun of him. Yeah. Anyway, Robert, what's yours?
I got my first of the shot of the Pfizer vaccine.
Yes.
It was actually like a week ago, but I'm still, you know, I felt like I had like maybe a really mild flu for about 10 hours.
You might
or
have
so.
Had it.
Mm-hmm.
They say that if you have a reaction after the first shot, you might have had it. Or you
yeah,
didn't have it.
I got really sick actually about almost exactly a year ago. I got horribly ill at the Richmond gun rally that were like,
yep, I remember.
That I attended. I don't know if it was COVID. I don't remember coughing a whole lot or having any real lung issue, but it sucked. But yeah, I got my first vaccine shot. I know Sophie did too recently.
You did, Soph.
Oh yeah.
Nice.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. I've just been kind of on a little high about how cool the concept of a vaccine is.
Yeah.
I enjoy thinking about how neat those are that we figured that out. They're like right under dogs in terms of my list of things we've done that I think are pretty rad.
Well, I'd like to see the virus do the Westminster Dog Show. So
I mean
the vaccine.
I would prefer not to see that actually. Yeah. Either way. Well, friends, let's lead into a tough but necessary conversation. So I don't know, what, 2 weeks ago? Was it even two? Yeah, 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. We had Christopher Wong on to talk about not just kind of the present epidemic of anti-Asian racism and hate crimes directed particularly against elderly Asians, but about the long history of violence towards Asians and anti-Asian racism in the United States. And then the next week, there was a mass shooting that targeted particularly Asian women working at a series of massage parlors in Atlanta. And since then, there's been another mass shooting in Boulder that I'm sure we'll talk about later. But we wanted to have Christopher back on. And also, we wanted to, some details came out about the shooter in Atlanta. And there's been a bunch of kind of, I think, verging on misinformation about, oh, no, this wasn't an anti-Asian hate crime. This was about his sex addiction. He came from a very specific religious background and was kind of inculcated within a specific thing that I think purity culture is the best term for. So I also brought in a very good friend of mine, Eve Ettinger, who grew up in, I guess you'd say, an adjacent religious community. And our goal for this week is to kind of facilitate a conversation between Christopher and Eve and hopefully arrive at kind of a greater understanding of the dynamics of the situation and what led to all of those murders.
Yes.
I'm glad to be here. Yeah, I hate being here for these reasons.
Yeah, it's not fun.
I'm glad.
I don't like having this expertise, but hey.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure Christopher's in a similar boat.
Yeah.
You know, so the day after we recorded the last episode, I was talking to one of my friends. We were talking about this, and I was saying, okay, the only thing that you could consider even vaguely good about the sort of, like, the only sort of vague silver lining about the anti-Asian violence was that it was basically all people doing blunt force stuff, which meant, I mean, we were talking about hundreds of attacks, mm-hmm. but, you know, the body count wasn't that high because it turns out it's extremely hard to kill people by just beating them to death. And, you know, that all changed last week.
Yeah,
we finally got the combination of person who wants to kill Asian people and has guns, which.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things, I think, unfortunately, if you were paying attention, you knew was coming. You know, it was I felt kind of similarly to when we finally had the Christchurch shooting of just like, this is good. This is going to happen. The warning signs are here. Okay, there's, you know, it's happened now. Which is, I guess there's a particular kind of horror in seeing it on the horizon and knowing you can't stop it.
I'm sitting here being like, yes, I kind of up with these kinds of guys. Like, I know this type, and it's, you know, I'm glad it took this long to happen. I wish it had never happened, but you know, not surprised. And it's good that people are talking about it now.
Could you give us a little bit of context, Eve, and sort of what purity culture is and what you understand of kind of where this guy's religious upbringing would have intersected with his actions?
Okay, so there's just so much to cover in terms of where this intersects with the anti-Asian sentiment that he's you know, reacting to. But the purity culture, essentially, it's the modern versions of it that you might have heard, the Silver Ring thing, Josh Harris, the courtship stuff, all of that I grew up with, really comes out of a very white supremacist, white colonizer kind of mindset, where white virginity is seen as the epitome of purity and this thing that needs to be protected. And that, you know, you have all of these conversations happening around like the over-sexualization of Black girls and how they're forced to, you know, grow up too quickly because they're treated like adults with sexual agency, because in contrast with the cult of white virginity, they're not allowed to have that kind of purity or that kind of, you know, idealized innocence. And so the history goes way, way, way back, but the current versions of it is pretty heavily religious and is based on some really fundamentalist misinterpretations of various biblical texts and is treating things like masturbation as sinful. So, you know, for you, just like a short preview of like, I grew up thinking that I had a masturbation addiction because I did it at all. And that was something that was just seen as like so foreign for a woman, someone being raised as a woman, to have a sex drive, that like that was seen as sinful. And so I grew up with this huge sense of shame around that. And so when you have that kind of, you know, these cultures that are this subculture that's really repressive and really demonizes any kind of sexuality and expression of sexuality as bad, you just, the mindset gets very, very limited very quickly.
Yeah. And it's hard, I think, for a lot of, well, I don't know, there's elements of this, I guess, in all of kind of mainstream American culture, right? This kind of like demonization of sex and sexual urges. I think it is hard for most of us to get into the headspace of somebody who is being taught that, who is being led to believe that like this is a major medical problem that they have, right? Like that's kind of the, and it seems like that's what this guy felt like, the fact that these people were providing a service that he was using because that service was sexual was ruining his life. Like that's not a thing this guy decided on his own.
Do we even know that?
That's what he was claimed to the police, that he had a sex addiction and that he like was fed. Well, that's what the police said.
So here's the thing. I've done in my snooping around on his church's website on the Wayback Machine.
Yeah.
What's left up. They have connections to groups that taught similar stuff to the stuff that I was raised or have overlap with the things I was taught. But they have a link on there about internet accountability, and there's a blocking software that they are recommending on the church's official website for that. Basically, my family had something similar growing up, where it'd be like, if you went to a sexually explicit piece of content on the internet, it would send an email to your accountability partner notifying them that you had visited this website.
Jesus Christ.
And so when he says sex addiction, we don't need to even jump to the conclusion that he was actually sexually active at all.
Absolutely.
Because it was like a sex addiction in this community could be as little as like watching porn once a week or jacking off a couple times a day. Like that's a sex addiction in this world. I don't want to get too far into the weeds with it, but that's, you know, that's the kind of stuff that, like, so when everybody's saying, oh, these were sex workers, that's a whole jump that I'm not comfortable making, because, and his assertion that he was, you know, this was his sex addiction, that doesn't necessarily connect, because he doesn't have to be sexually active to have a sex addiction in this community's definition of things.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's accurate to say he could have just been, like, literally receiving massages and attracted to these people. Yeah. And that,
or thinking
that,
about getting massages.
Or thinking about getting a massage.
Well, like, so there was a whole book that was by Josh Harris about lust that was given to teens around the time I was in high school. I think it came out in like 2008. 2005, something like that. But it changed titles a couple of times, so I'm not sure what the final one was. But essentially it was like, if you can masturbate without thinking about someone, without objectifying a human, it's not a sin. That was the essential premise in that. So if he's like going there, getting a massage, and then jacking off to it later, he is committing a sin in his own mind.
So I just want to interject to say that it is possible that this parlor was sexual in nature. I haven't seen that officially. I just was looking it up to check.
Yeah, it's on Grubhub.
There is, but it doesn't matter. And also, I mean, there's a whole broader conversation about how we talk about sex workers and the fact that people are dancing around that aspect of this story, when at the end of the day, it doesn't matter either way.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting is what I saw very clearly happening, in part from the police officer who made the first public comments, who was himself super racist and was sharing anti-Chinese memes related to COVID, was this attempt to, like, deflect from claims that this was at all related in anti-Asian bigotry and instead angle it as, well, this is just a troubled young man with a sexual problem who had a bad day. Yeah. And I think what's interesting to me is the kind of layers of white supremacy baked within this, both in terms of what Eve, you were talking about, with there's this idea that, like, particularly white sexuality, there's something sacred about, like, innocence and something there. And then there are these other shades of kind of some very old standing stereotypes, particularly about Asian women. Like, Christopher, you talked about last time, there was a period of time when the United States defined any Asian woman in the United States as a sex worker. And so I think one thing is clear there, and Katie and Eve, you're both very right to hesitate to make any claims about what was actually happening at the massage parlor. But regardless of what was going on, I think it's impossible to disentangle white supremacy and anti-Asian bigotry from this crime.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if you had kind of anything more to say on that angle, Christopher, just based on what Eve was talking about a little bit ago.
Yeah, I can do two things here. So one, there was a Red Canary song, which is a sex work group, like advocacy group, that I'm going to talk more about in a little bit. They had a vigil for the victims, and one of the people at the vigil was a sex worker organizer named Kailin Zhang, and she was talking about specifically the ties between this and Christianity, and I think this is something that's sort of important, is that racism has, you know, it can wear a lot of different ideologies. Like, you know, you can be sort of like conventional mainstream Republicanism, you can have racist Democrats, you can have sort of racist evangelicals, even especially in the 1800s, it wears the face of the workers' movement a lot. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in relation to this specific thing, she said, quote, they hate us, this is talking about sex workers, they hate us so they can hate themselves less. Mm. And that it's about, you know, it's about this, like, this is because they hate themselves, and they have this, they displace this sort of hatred onto other people, and that makes them feel better. And, you know, they, you know, you're talking about, like, you're not supposed to, like, objectify women, but that's, like, all they do. That's their whole religion, right? It's just turning women into objects and turning, you know, and this is replicated, you know, even after, you know, after the massacre, right? When, you know, like, social workers show up, when the government shows up, and this is one of the things she was talking about, is that, you know, all the whole system like of clients, of judges, of social workers, of the state, just treats sex workers, particularly Asian sex workers, exactly the same way as the shooter does. And it doesn't matter whether they're there to like save them or whether they're there to, you know, kill them. They have the same fundamental beliefs and the same sort of displacement of their own like self-hatred and their own sort of inability to grapple with the fact that like what they are feeling is something they've created and not something that's the responsibility of the woman they're objectifying. And there's also something I think I want to talk about with the way that sort of massage parlors and sex work gets conflated. And I want to put another quote from this is Esther Kay, who's one of the co-directors of Red Canary Song, said, quote, "The conflation of massage parlors and sex workers without any nuance is very specific to anti-Asian racism against Asian women." And, you know, I noticed something really interesting. So this is a quote that was put in The Guardian. Now, The Guardian, when they talked about Red Canary, said that they were, quote, "a grassroots Chinese massage parlor worker coalition." And I thought that was really weird because I know Red Canary Song. Like, that's not what?
Yeah, that doesn't sound right.
Yeah, yeah. So here's what's on their website. Quote, "We are a grassroots collective of Asian and migrant sex workers." So this is the shit that we're dealing with here, right? The Guardian went to Red Canary Song's website, wrote down their description, and then changed sex workers to massage parlor workers.
They literally whitewashed it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's stunning. It's stunning. And, you know, like this is part of what's happening here is the media is completely unprepared to deal with this because, you know, yeah. Because they're also racist.
Yeah, I mean, and it's the kind of thing I can't even know if that was a specific editorial change or if that was somebody in their head reading sex worker and replacing it automatically with massage parlor worker. Like both
without
are
interchangeable.
Very feasible. Yeah.
And I'm thinking about how culturally for so long it's been acceptable to make jokes or associations to that effect. Like, oh, you're going to get a Thai massage. Is it, you know?
Yeah.
And the fact that I personally have not been into any of those establishments without seeing an explicit sign about do not touch our massage therapists.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was talking to a couple of sex worker friends about this after this happened. And one of the things that was coming up was, it's so annoying when I'm here to do my job and you want a massage. That's not something I do.
It goes both ways. Yeah. It's like, I that's not my training is in here. Yeah, absolutely.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
One of the things this made me think about is an article I was reading recently in Vanity Fair about a documentary that came out called Tales of the Grim Sleeper, which was about a serial killer in Los Angeles who targeted primarily black sex workers and wasn't caught for a very long time because his victims were black. And there's a quote in there that I think ties into all of this in a pretty horrifying way. Quote, "One of the most troubling pieces of information presented in the film is that police officers are reported to have used the unofficial acronym NHI, No Humans Involved, to describe the slayings of prostitutes and drug addicts."
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
That's not just Los Angeles, although it happened here. That is a thing that cops do. NHI, No Humans Involved. They were sex workers. They were drug addicts. They were, you know. And I'm sure... not to get us too much out of kind of the topic of today, but it's all very tied together. Kind of the white, there's I think people talk too much about white supremacy as a single thing rather than a series of interlocking systems. And you've got you've got white supremacy within this religious this strain of religious teaching. You've got it within law enforcement. You've got it within these various socioeconomic systems. You've got it within the immigration system. And I think all of that, it's like these series of wheels that are kind of working together to make slayings like what happened in Atlanta inevitable.
This was one of the things that made, this is why everyone sort of, you know, if you've been watching how people have been talking about it afterwards, people just sort of lost their minds and couldn't analyze it because, you know, I mean, this is a place where basically almost all of the sites of violence like come together. I mean, you have a bunch of people who are migrant workers who This is one of the other things about tying this directly to the police is that, you know, people who work in massage parlors do not call the cops.
Yeah.
Because, mm-hmm. yeah, for very obvious reasons. I mean, there was a report from Butterflies, a sex worker group out in Toronto, who said that, yeah, 50% of all massage parlor workers reported some kind of threat of safety at their work. They don't call the cops because, you know, a lot of those threats, right, are from cops who, yep. like, constantly, just over and over and over again, do these raids on massage parlors as part of the sort of anti-trafficking thing. But, you know, a lot, you know, they'll do these raids and they'll claim, oh, we freed 26 people from trafficking, and then you look at what actually happened, and it's no, they took 26 people, they stripped them all of their identification, they took their passports, and they just sort of kicked them out into the street. They never charged any of the people in the massage place, which, you know, you would think, right, if this was actually an anti-trafficking thing, that they would, you know, like, prosecute the people who are doing the trafficking. But no, they don't, because, you know, and this is the other thing, if insofar as you're talking about trafficking, well, guess who does trafficking? It's the police.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I just want to, like, put a plug in here for the You're Wrong About podcast has a couple of really good episodes on busting myths on sex trafficking. And, like, so one of the things that they were talking about in one of those episodes was, like, you know, you might have that number of, like, okay, 29 people we rescued or whatever. But it won't count repeats. So it'll be like the same, if they're like raiding the same place over and over again, and these individuals are repeatedly being arrested, they will identify them over and over again as a new number. So they're not, the numbers are really inflated and they're really badly calculated. And I just want to kind of pan off of the trafficking and the cops, like, the history of like the Christian community's like response to trafficking as a concept is extremely classist, mm-hmm. and extremely tied to this like Madonna horror complex. And the way you see it like originate goes back to Victorian England and the Salvation Army. And they basically were trying to create a moral panic about children being trafficked. And there were so many orphans that were being shuttled around and being used in, you know, these exploitative labor conditions. And they were trying to help them, but they wanted to get attention on the issue. So they staged they paid someone to go procure a child. And then, you know, the guy shows up and is like, okay, we got it. Like, this is happening. So we have proof that it's happening, even though he was the one who facilitated it. Just like the cops facilitate these kinds of stings. The exact same method. So the Salvation Army has been doing this since then. And it kind of all goes back to, I mean, there's all these Victorian ideals of like womanhood and what it means. There's this poem by Coventry Patmore that I think is really important. Called The Angel in the House, and it's talking about like the ideal woman, and she's pure and she's passive and she's takes care of the children and she's completely self-sacrificing and self-effacing, and so anyone who's going out and doing anything and taking initiative for themselves and having sex on their own terms, this is something that can't exist according to these tropes and binaries that exist in the Christian imagination.
Well, and I think also the Victorian era is crucial to this. I think people don't understand this. Before the Victorian era, like, people had way, like, the people's sort of social and like sort of sexual cultural politics was way closer to us in even like the 1600s and 1700s. And in the 1800s, all the things that we think of as conservatism or that have been there for like forever or whatever, like that's when all of this is formed. Because the Victorians are just the worst people who have ever lived. Like, you know, if what you want to talk about, like, there's a lot of things happening in this period, right? Like, you know, if you want to talk about sort of anti-colonial violence, like the these people are like in India, right? There's a rebellion against British rule. Like, the British strap people to cannons to like destroy their bodies so that like they can't be buried properly. Like, this is the kind of stuff these people are doing. And you know, it's not a coincidence. Like, this is the moment when you get both the sort of the Christian solidification of sort of the submissive woman. And it's also the exact moment where you get a really solidified conception of you know, the sort of Orientalist conception of Asian women as these like submissive butterfly women who are like dolls. You get people going to Japan and writing about, you know, writing about like Japanese women like this, and you know, this spreads like wildfire across like mass culture. And this is these are all like all of the tropes that we see today, like are from the Victorian era, with basically the exception of the sex worker thing, which is like all Asian sex workers, and the me love you long time shit from Kubrick. Yeah. Like that's that stuff has to do with, you know, one of the other really horrific scenes of sort of mass violence against Asian women, which is, you know, I would say this, like the people in this region just cannot get a break. You have the invasion of the Philippines by the U.S. You start to see mass violence there. And then, you know, if you're in China and you're in Korea, you get invaded by Japan. And Japan sets up the comfort women system. And, you know, people sort of know about this. It's this mass system of sexual slavery. What people tend not to know about is that the Americans, you know, at the end of World War II, the Americans essentially inherit this empire. Like they take over its logistics networks, yeah. And they inherit the comfort women system, and there's complicated ways that this works, but they, you know, a lot of the sort of, because one of the things that happens in the Korean War is Korea is just completely leveled, it's absolutely devastated, millions of people unemployed, and you get these little camp towns. You have a million women who are basically forced into sex work by the fact that the U.S. have just annihilated their country. And but you know, and the way that stuff is organized is, you know, it's descendant from the stuff the Japanese were doing. And you know, you see this again repeated in Vietnam and all the stuff that comes out of that. And it's, you just sort of, you know, you step back and look at this, and it's just colonialism, imperialism, that's just this nightmare that never ends. It's like the faces change, sometimes it's the French, sometimes it's the Japanese, sometimes it's the Americans, but you know, the violence is the same, and it keeps going and going and going, and it's just, you know, and it you know, the violence sort of rebounds back and forth between, you know, what the U.S. Army does, and it comes back home, and then it goes back abroad again, and it comes back home, and you end up with, you know, the situation we're in today, where just the whole view of Asian women is based on sort of American sort of imperial fears and American imperial like victories and defeats. And
yeah,
there's a lot of sort of grim aspects of this too, where you get, so, you know, one of the reactions to this from inside the sort of Asian American community is you get these sort of nominally anti-imperialist, like anti-sex worker groups, for people who see this violence and are like, okay, well the problem here is that there are sex workers like at all. And this goes to really bad places real fast. So there's a group called Affirm, who you've probably run into them, who are trying to sort of like exploit the killings as like a, hey, we can do anti-sex work stuff. Except, you know, Affirm in Hawaii was vandalizing massage parlors with like really terrifying graffiti stuff. And it's like, okay.
Sounds like people that should be casting moral judgments.
Yeah, but it's also just, you know, but part of the reason, like, people have a problem, okay, this is sort of bad. That's a bad way of explaining it. But there's, you know, one of the fundamental problems of sort of anti-Asian racism against Asian women is that, you know, Asian women are at all times essentially treated like as how the rest of society treats sex workers, right? Like, it's, you know, you're supposed to be an object, your body's supposed to be available for white men at all times. And a lot of people's reactions to this is, well, we need to separate Asian women from sex work, right? But, you know, fundamentally, you know, you're dealing with racism here, but you're also dealing with the fact that this is just how we treat sex workers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, we arrest them constantly, we constantly harass them. Like, you know, I talked about Ying Sung in the last time, but, you know, it's incredibly relevant here that the police just hound them to their deaths, the police abuse them, and you can't really solve this problem unless you're able to, like, unless, you know, you're dealing with these problems simultaneously.
Well, you're saying, I mean, just like we were saying earlier, like, this is an intersection of a particularly virulent strain of Christian misogyny with classism, with racism. Like, this is where those three things are coming together. And, you know, when you look at, you know, how Christians treat their own women, you know, I grew up in a fundamentalist homeschool corporal role. You are going to Google terms. That's the way to find how I was raised, a Quiverful family. And I was raised to, with the idea that my purpose in life was to get married and have more babies and homeschool them and raise them for Jesus and repeat the process that my mother had. I'm the oldest of nine. And so, you know, there was this mythology around, you know, what a biblical woman was. And if you look at the Council of Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, they've got like these whole treatises that you can read about like what they thought an ideal woman should be. And it goes back to the angel in the house kind of trope from the Victorian era, where they had this neo-Victorian nostalgia for this idea of womanhood that never actually existed, where, you know, the woman is passive, the woman is a receiver, the woman is constantly sexually available. The woman is fertile. The woman is there to provide for the children and take care of things and make life easy for her husband. And so there's all of these like gender roles that they're putting on their own women. But they have to protect those women because they are ensuring the racial purity of that community. And so when you step outside of that, of course they're not going to treat other women well. Mm-hmm. They're not treating their own women well. And once these women have no value to them socially, it's going to get a whole lot worse.
They can take out, they can act out, they can take out,
they're disposable.
Their repression, you know? Yeah. On other people. Yes. Disposable.
And, you know, and I think that the purity aspect's very important to this. And the, even sort of is looking at historical violence against Asian women, I mean, this is, you know, if we were talking about the Page Act, which is the act that, like, that supposedly banned anyone who was in the country for, quote, immoral purposes, who were lewd. Like, this is the justification for this, again, was, you know, about maintaining American racial purity. They're very open about this.
Yeah.
And, you know, Asian women are, you know, are seen as a threat to sort of American racial purity, and that meant you had to do ethnic cleansing. And I think, you know, there's a lot of ethnic cleansing that happens in especially the 1800s, but even after that. And I want to take a moment to say something about mass shootings in general. This is something I first heard from Vicky Osterweil, although I think there's sort of precedence to this, which is about mass, the sort of mass shootings we see today are basically just sort of individualized versions of the sort of mass communal violence of the 1800s and 1900s. And so, you know, if you want to look at what the sort of model for the shooter is, you know, you can look at the sort of anti-Chinese riots and broader anti-Asian riots, because, and this is the pressing thing about this, every single different Asian American national ethnic group has their own massacre that specifically targeted them. You know, I mean, just to go through, there's a whole, just particularly on the West Coast, this entire wave of ethnic cleansing. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it starts in the 1860s, but just to like read some of these, so you get an understanding, like a partial list of just like how many of them there are. There's the Chinese massacre of 1871, San Francisco riots of 1877, 1885. This is one of the common themes of this is Chinese expulsion from Tacoma, which, you know, they'll just run every Chinese person. It depends on the ethnic group. There's also like every Indian person in, I think it's Everett, I think, just gets run out to Canada. There's the Rock Spring Massacre in 1885. There's the Issaquah attacks also in that same year in 1886. Seattle has a riot to try to, you know, there's an anti-Asian riot. There's the Hell's Canyon Massacre, which is another thing that happens is that like rail workers and miners who are Asian just get slaughtered by particularly white workers who are pissed off at them for, like, you know, the fact that their wages are lower. You know,
they're brought in to bust the union. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's more than that, though. The Chinese workers who are brought in this in the 1800s are a lot of ways are supposed to be replacements for sort of enslaved black labor, and also has to do with a transportation problem where you can't really, like, it's actually like hard to get across the U.S. And so there's no good way to sort of just mass, like, export sort of the newly freed slaves from the South to the West Coast. So they bring in Asian workers to do this. And, you know, this just drives white labor insane, and they just start massacring people. And then, you know, this happens, and this continues like through the 1900s. Like in 1907, there's something called the Pacific Coast Race Riots, where, you know, this is a multinational riot. And it starts in San Francisco, but by the end of it, it goes to Bellingham, and like there's an anti-Chinese riot like in Vancouver.
Jesus.
Yeah, and you know this is the tradition that the shooter is working in, right? You know, and there's a specificity of sort of evangelical anti-sex worker violence here, but there's also just, you know, this is the modern continuation of just the ethnic cleansing attempts that, you know, in a lot of cases succeeded. You can see this in California. If you're driving through California, sometimes they'll just be random Buddhist temples, and there's no Asian people there. And the reason there's no Asian people there is because every single one of them was ran out, and the rest of the area is completely white. But you know, the things that they built are just still there. And I think monuments, the cleansing.
So I teach freshman comp and a couple other classes. So I teach a lot of young teens just out of high school. And one of the things that I see all the time is just an absolute ignorance about American complicity in these kinds of things. Racism is seen as something that's in the past. There's not really a good education about these things. So the responsibility of whiteness in all of these horrific events is never addressed. And so they're just inheriting the whatever is in their family community, and it's unaddressed. And so they're coming to this with this, you know, white innocence again, like, I don't know anything, so I couldn't have done it. And that's part of what's being preserved by not teaching it.
Yep.
And this kind of, it all goes together.
There's this other element of white, of American exceptionalism that I see getting wrapped up in how we don't talk about these acts of ethnic cleansing that Christopher was just going over, because if you look at what actually happens in the acts, if you look at their death toll, they don't sound wildly different from things that in our lifetime have occurred in parts of the Middle East, in Africa. And part of, I think, why we don't talk about it is that it would mean acknowledging that the same kind of strains of racial mass violence are a central part of American identity, and we don't like to think about that.
Well, and I think it's worse than that, because, you know, if you start doing that, right, if you go to the 1800s, you go to the anti-Chinese massacres, you have to go back further. And, you know, when you go back in the history of the United States, and then this is happening in the 1800s, like at the same time, you know, you realize that, oh, yeah, wait, hold on. Like this entire country is built on the fact that we ethnically cleansed innumerable peoples. Destroyed them.
Yeah. Last week, I just want to interject because this is – I have a relevant story here. Last week, as this news broke and we were all digesting it, I was chatting with a Korean-American friend of mine, and his wife is from Germany. And he said, when these things happen, and over the past year, I've been thinking about this a lot. And for my wife, growing up in Germany, it's illegal to deny the Holocaust.
Yes.
It's taught in their schools. And I'm not here saying that Germany has everything figured out. They obviously have a right-wing problem. But this element of their society is a forced reckoning with their history and with their past. And it's a very, very big difference, a stark difference from how we are raised, just with this narrative of America being the best and a democracy and the great experiment. And it just leaves out everything that happened getting us to this point, you know?
And I think that's on purpose.
It is. Yeah. It's absolutely
it's
on purpose.
Because it gives us white people the plausible deniability of, I didn't know, I didn't do it. You can just shut down the conversation there.
Separate. It's like those people did it, but not me. Well, you still are a part of this, and it's still part of your legacy. And the ramifications of their actions are still here. So it's on us to do this work.
The fact that your parents were able to get a mortgage is a result of you benefiting from these systems. So shut up.
Yes.
Well, even with Germany, though, like, so, you know, Germany, well, okay, you could talk a lot about the fact that, like, so much of the German economy is based on the fact that they won't pay reparations to all the Holocaust victims, mm-hmm. because if they did, it would destroy their whole GDP.
Yeah.
On. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the other ones, so Germany did its own genocides in Africa. There was the Herero and Namaqua genocide. Oh, yeah. And yeah. that one they don't really recognize.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
And you know, this is part of how they avoid sort of Holocaust accountability too, because, you mm-hmm. know, so Himmler's dad, I think it was either his dad or his grandpa, was like the commanding officer in charge, like one of the commanding officers who was in charge of the troops that did this genocide.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah,
you know, and there's
yeah.
Yeah, and there's nothing like, you know, and you don't really get this that much in the German education system, and you know, they deflect blame in similar ways to sort of the Americans do.
I mean, and I think a big part of why that happens, why Germany is allowed to get away with ignoring their colonial genocides in Africa, is because if you call Germany to task for their massacres of the Herero or the other shit they were getting up to in Namibia, you also have to acknowledge France and England did even worse things.
You have to acknowledge every other place. Yeah.
And then you have to look at like not every other concentration place. Camps and the treatment of mentally ill people in Germany were modeled on US practices.
So you can't force a deeper dig.
Yeah.
dig. All right. So I partially rescind my point about Germany, but I still say that this acknowledgement of this thing that happened yes. is part of this, part of what we need right here.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
When I was younger and kind of more on the libertarian end of things, I was concerned by German laws restricting free speech as related to the Holocaust. And I've come around to an understanding that it shouldn't be legal to yell fire in a crowded theater, right? Why is that? Because that is an act of speech that can directly result in human harm. So that you don't have the right to do that. Mm-hmm. Denial of the Holocaust, and it's the Holocaust is not specific, the only thing, but denial of genocide in general, because we could say the same thing about the Armenian genocide, which just last year had another surge in. Denial of genocide is morally identical to urging genocide, because that's where it leads to. And in one way you'll see this, I just got sent a couple of leaked conversations between a group of Pacific Northwest Proud Boys, where mm-hmm. one of them, this famous street brawler, Tiny, was chatting with another Proud Boy about the Holocaust. And someone said, well, you know, it didn't happen, right? And the way the conversation went was like, well, then we should do it, you know? And that I've seen this happen a bunch within white supremacist spaces. And oftentimes it'll start as a joke, but obviously we know that that's not where it ends. It is an act of violence to deny the Holocaust. It's an act of violence to deny any genocide or ethnic cleansing. These are all, because when you are denying it or when you are hiding it, you are saying, I'm okay with this. Like that's where it always goes to, right? That's the end result of that process. And I think there's another aspect of this that ties the Holocaust together with what Christopher was talking about, with these acts of ethnic cleansing on the West Coast, with, in fact, the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. Mm-hmm. And it's the thing we don't talk about with the Holocaust very much. The Holocaust is often framed as, well, the Germans had all of these conspiratorial beliefs about Jewish people, and they did, and that was a significant part of it. A huge driver of the Holocaust was purely economic, was people wanting the things that Jewish Germans possessed and then wanting the things that Jewish people in other parts of the country possessed. And there were elements of it that were not that, but a big part of the Holocaust was what was called Aryanization, which was businesses being taken from Jewish families and given to Aryans. And that was not, when Christopher says like reparations have not really been paid, that was never undone to a large extent.
That's,
And let's just, so I grew up in Central California in Visalia. All of that farmland mm-hmm. was taken from Japanese immigrants mm-hmm. when they were put in the concentration camps and given to white farmers. And nothing has been done to make that right either. It's the exact same thing.
The great part about that is that the first people to call for Japanese internment was the White Californian farm owners association. which is great because, you know, this is
their politics haven't changed, basically.
Yeah,
well, no, it hasn't.
They, you know, this is the thing with the white farmers. The Californian white farmers don't have a farm; they suck at it, and so they constantly have to import different sources of labor in order to actually do the farming because they can't, right? And this is why sort of labor politics, like, you know, this is why strikes by undocumented workers are actually extremely, they tend to be very effective in sort of like in sort of agricultural parts of California, because, you know, again, if they can't import, and a lot of times like indigenous sort of workers from Latin America, right? If they can't do this, literally the whole system shuts down and like the crops all die because they don't, like the white farmers don't know how to do it. And the amount of violence that has been inflicted on people, like, because these people don't know how to farm, and because, you know, because they have this sort of whole racist ideology, you know, this is another place where the racist ideology comes in. It's, well, okay, we could subjugate these people to get them to do our farming for us, but, like, God help them if they ever actually start doing it on their own. We're gonna take it all from them.
Well, and there's, there's this whole thing of, it's like, they're destroying the Central Valley's ability to produce anything the way they have been, because it's not sustainable. And the valley used to be maintained by the indigenous peoples in certain ways, and the agricultural practices have been completely demolishing all of that work that was done. So it's not going to be fertile anymore. It's just,
if you want to be horrified, Google, like, do some research on where the Salton Sea came from.
Oh yeah, the Salton Sea. Yeah. Favorite stories about this. Yeah. No, they're essentially refusing to acknowledge their own racism is going to kill them. It's a moebius.
Do you want to pivot, if we want to do another sort of Latin American connection to this violence?
Yeah, how do we want to get into this?
Yeah, do we want to pivot briefly and talk about some of my least favorite people who have ever existed, the role of Christian missionaries in this?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a resounding yes.
So to get there, I want to talk about the International Justice Mission. Can we start there?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Please do.
So if we're looking at how Christians have treated sex work and sex trafficking and all this, one of the things that is a really good case study of, like, how this has not changed at all from the methods that the Salvation Army was using during the Victorian era to today, is to look at the International Justice Mission. There's a really good article by Melissa Garrett Grant, kind of on Rewire, that gets into what exactly they have done to fuck up. But basically, it's the same story. They're collaborating with the police. There are people who are maybe sex workers, may not be sex workers, but basically these are people who are poor, and the group is working with the police to facilitate raids, and then they're rescuing them, and then putting them in, you know, different housing situations that are conditional on behaving in certain ways according to the Christian, you know, moral code. It's just, it's really, really gross. It's really colonist, and it tracks with the same way that Christian missionaries often act when they are abroad. So I grew up in pretty missions heavy church communities. This was part of the kind of the water I was swimming in, and something about it always made me really uncomfortable. And I was finally able to put my finger on it when I was abroad in for Peace Corps, and there would be these Christian missionaries that would come in to Kyrgyzstan where I was working, and they would say, "We're volunteers, we're Peace Corps volunteers," even though they weren't, and they didn't have the right visa. And they'd be there to do missions work, which was illegal, and they would have been kicked out of the country if they'd been caught. But because they said that they were Peace Corps volunteers, we had trouble building certain relationships with certain communities because the conditions of Bible study being attached to English lessons made people leery of us.
That's
and
awful.
This is the same kind of stuff that is happening when they're quote unquote rescuing these sex workers. And so there's this, you know, to tie this all together, current American Christian evangelical purity culture has this particular hero, Jim Elliot, who, not to speculate too widely about people's sexuality after they're dead, but like, there's a good chance this guy was gay, and you know, that might have made his whole purity thing a lot easier. Anyway, he was one of the missionaries that was in Ecuador, in the 50s, mid 50s. And they were trying to connect with this untouched people, which is bullshit, but, they were trying to connect with this community. They were working with the Shell Oil Company for their resources. They were staying out of a Shell station and using the Shell plane to fly in and connect with this community. And this community, the Guarani, killed them. And their wives stayed on and tried to connect with this community and eventually did and lived with them and taught them English and did the whole colonization thing. And there's a whole awful history that results from that. But Jim Elliot's journals were turned into a book by his wife after his death. And she wrote this book about their courtship, about their romantic relationship called Passion and Purity, where she's codifying these ideals of, you know, you can be chaste and you can be passionate. And, you know, he checked with my dad and, you know, he wouldn't even kiss me until he told me that he loved me, and he wouldn't tell me that he loved me until he had proposed to me. You know, all of these layers that you see kind of reflected in the current evangelical purity culture thinking. And so that book really influenced Josh Harris, who wrote the seminal work, I Kissed Dating Goodbye, and is later renounced it. A lot of this like purity culture stuff comes from these same people who are going into these communities with the assumption that their way of life is wrong and needs to be corrected.
And I think there's you know, the sort of evangelical movement, you see the violence. This is another thing I'm like sort of harping on about, but it's true. Is, you know, you get two reflections of the violence. You get the sort of imperialist violence, and you get the violence at home. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I grew up with a like sort of even in like an evangelical college town, and like, you know, so half of my friends like are missionaries now, and then people I didn't like, basically, you know, they would say things like, I'm going to go join the army so I can kill all Muslims. And like that was like common. And, you know, this, you know, you get basically both, you know, you have the, like, there's very, very little difference sort of ideologically in what's happening here between the people who go join the army to kill Muslims, the people who sort of are like, oh, I'm going to go save the souls or whatever of like indigenous people in Ecuador. And, you know, the sort of the anti-sex worker people, and, you know, like these, the just like the white supremacist murderers who are, you know, shooting up massage parlors. It's the same sort of ideological apparatus.
Yeah, they're all on a crusade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same one.
Literally. I mean, if you think about the origin of that word.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully it goes as well as the original one.
Right.
Like, admittedly, like, I'm down to skip the child soldier phase, but like...
Oh, but that was the best part.
I'm sorry. What are we here for if not that?
As a victim of the child soldier phase, I reject that.
I'm changing my position. I'm with Eve now.
I am child soldier neutral.
Bold.
Yeah, I'm not ageist. That's where it lands for me. I'm not ageist. I think.
Oh, so you believe in children's rights to die on the field of battle?
I do. I think everyone has the right to be a soldier.
I mean, I agree to an extent. I think parents have the right to hit their parents back, but anyway,
let's just give 10-year-olds cars.
I think we need to make it mandatory that all truck drivers are under the age of 14. I would agree with you there, Katie.
I think they would do a lot better job.
I mean, they
would be fun.
They wouldn't see over the steering wheel, but I don't know that matters.
Yeah, I mean,
we'll just cut a little peephole in the middle of the dash hole board.
It'll be good. It'll be fine. None of this is very fun to talk about, except for talking about child truck drivers, which is fun to imagine.
Always fun.
I mean, yeah. I can make jokes about this all day, but anytime I make a joke about this to someone who's an army, they're like, oh my God, that really happened? And I'm like,
yeah, I know.
I mean, that's the problem in general of like having a trauma that isn't understood by the people around you. Is you're most people it find humor a helpful way of coping, and then people think that you're either a monster or making things up, because it's seems so strange to hear people laugh about something like that.
Yeah.
So do you want to you want to jump from this to children and conspiracy theories?
Yeah.
And how this is connected?
Oh, you mean like the children who kind of wind up in like focused on like the fact that whenever we have these like big panics over sex trafficking and stuff, it's always this false idea that there's like 4 and 5 year olds being mass trafficked as opposed to like the reality.
Oh, well, we could talk about that too. Yeah. We could talk about the whole like the evangelical community is, you know, protecting dozens and dozens and dozens of sexual predators who are preying on the children in their Sunday schools and mm-hmm. homes, and yet they're focused on we have to fix sex trafficking outside of this community. Yeah, there's that whole thing. No, I actually wanted to talk about J.R. Rush, Jimmy.
Oh, you yeah. You've told me about him.
Yeah. So Rush Jimmy, the reason he's relevant is this church that the shooter went to is part of a larger group of churches that has loose ties to the ideological inheritance of J.R. Rush Jimmy. So Rush Jimmy was this Presbyterian philosopher. He was very libertarian, you know, free market Austrian economics kind of guy. But he also had this whole interpretation of theology that really kind of created what we call Christian dominionism now. He's a Reconstructionist. And the idea that Reconstructionists have is essentially America was supposed to be a Christian nation. This goes back to the whole like, is it William Bradford City on a Hill speech he gives on the Mayflower? And which is, you know, they're recreating an idea of America that never existed. Mm-hmm. So America's supposed to be this Christian nation. America is the new, under the new covenant, replacing the Jews because the Jews fucked up. And American Christians have inherited this status as God's people. And America as a nation is supposed to fulfill that. And this means that we have to institute biblical laws to things like the stoning of rebellious sons and public execution of the gays and all of these other sorts of, you know, inhumane Old Testament codes. And if they're established, according to some subsects of the Reconstructionist thinkers, this is not all of them believe this, but a lot of them do. If those things are put in place, then Christ will return.
Oh, good. So, that's kind of, yeah.
So there's this whole, and I have so much that I could say about this. There's this whole angle that, like, I think they're stealing some ideas from Antonio Gramsci, where they're talking about like the seven spheres of culture that they're supposed to, you know, take over and how they're going to approach it. And there's a whole thing with like ADF and homeschooling and all that ties in. But essentially the idea of Christian dominion as part of the Christian mandate and having that tied to white supremacy, this church community, this group of, or the school of thought also believes in the curse of Ham, which
oh yes, is
the idea yeah. that Black people are descended from Ham, and Ham was cursed by Noah for laughing at Noah being drunk and naked in his tent one day, and therefore
oh, it sounds slavery, silly when you put it up like that.
Chattel, yeah, a lot of it.
Slavery in America is the like punishment from God that is just for that, and it's.
If for laughing at
oh god,
for laughing dick. At his dad being passed out naked in the tent. I mean, I'd laugh too.
Mm-hmm. Because it's funny. Mm. I mean, it all like you were both talking about earlier, it all kind of goes back, like the Victorian era isn't where it all starts, but it's where it all explodes. And there's the I think Christopher said earlier about how colonialism and white supremacy is just kind of this nightmare that never ends. And that has been true for the last couple of hundred years, but I do think it's important to acknowledge that there's a beginning point to it. There was a period of time before all of this existed and there were still plenty of problems. but they were different ones, you know? And I think about that a lot. I think about the fact that the Roman Empire would have looked like the average Roman citizen would have looked like you were out of your mind if you had tried to like argue that people with different skin colors were different levels of human. They'd be like, no, your level of humanity is determined by whether or not you're a citizen of the empire that I'm in. Like, of course, it has nothing to do with your skin color. Like, they wouldn't have gotten that because it hadn't started yet. And the fact that this is all, and a lot of what you're seeing in modern purity culture and in Christian dominionism is this desire to return to this period, this Victorian period, where the domination was kind of at its most unquestionable, right? It was this period in which there was no resistance effective on a global level to white supremacist imperialism. I think is really important, just to kind of to understand what it is they want to go back to, and also to understand what it looked like when they got their way. And, you know, it looked like the famine in Bengal. It looked like the Boxer Rebellion. It looked like...
And it's also really important to know that, like, it looked like all of those things, and also it didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the moral purity that they're envisioning literally never existed. The way Christian culture was literally never existed.
No, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kipling, there's some very good Kipling poems on that subject, but the one on Mandalay Bay, where he's talking about the way in which colonial officers of these companies acted in Asia. Send me somewhere east of Suez where the best is like the worst, where there ain't no Ten Commandments and a man can raise a thirst, you know? Mm. And the fact of the matter is, like, these people, if they got their way, wouldn't be pure. They would be maintaining, you know, brothels for their own use, and they would be violating all of the rules that they want to impose on other people. That's the way it always is.
Well, but, you know, that's what Christian forgiveness is for, right?
Yeah,
like, it's for them. It is not for any of the people they're abusing. Like,
well. And that's the thing. Like, if you look at how they treat the story of King David, this is their model for political leadership. The story of King David is like, this guy uses his power as king to rape his neighbor's wife and then sends the dude to the front lines to make sure he dies so that the guy never finds out that, like, he impregnated his wife and God forgives him because he repents. And he's still considered the good king. Like, what the fuck? Like, that's the model of good leadership. It's not that you are actually morally pure. It's that you get God's job done.
Yeah. Well,
unless you're a descendant of Ham. Sorry. Sorry, folks.
Yeah. Cause he laughed at his uh-huh. dad's dick. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, don't laugh at your dad's.
Yeah.
Dicks.
No, definitely laughing at Robert Dick.
Is that...
If I was going to summarize the Bible, that would be the lesson I would take out of it. Shit.
Christopher, is there anything that we missed?
Yeah.
You know, I'll say one last thing about how we get out of this.
Sure.
Because,
please.
You know, and there's no good answers to. I mean, you know, there are absolutely sort of like short-term things you can do that have to do with, you know, bystander trainings, you know, having community organizations that, you know, like, sort of move people around so that, you know, again, people aren't isolated and can't be picked off like that. But I mean, one of the things that I remember a lot of that I just could not deal with was particularly Asian liberals, but you saw a lot of this was people going like, oh, there's this historic night at the Oscars. A shooting happened. How could this have happened? And I can't think of like a sort of better indictment of politics of representation than that, right? It's, oh, hey, we're finally being represented in music or whatever, in film, and oh, they're still killing us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a couple of things there. One is that like people are using ethnic solidarity as a way to sort of mask this giant class divide. And, you know, you get Asian American groups having, like, Tony Zhu, who's the founder of DoorDash, like, speak at their events. And it's like, okay, this guy got rich by exploiting Asian workers, right? And, you know, you have the fact that, like, in New York, for example, like, Asian Americans have the highest poverty rate of, like, any racial group in the city, like, 23%. And, you know, you have to, at some point, you have to look at how you deal with this. And, you know, one of the things, going back to sort of what we were talking about, Ecuador, right? So, you know, the missionaries ally with the oil companies, and there's this sort of incredible imperial violence wreaked on them. But eventually people start to fight back. I mean, people are fighting that the whole time, but they start to really effectively fight back. And there's the formation of this group called the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador. And they're able to actually, you know, they're able to push back on the colonialists, they're able to push back on sort of oil extraction. They're able to do this because they have the ability to call an uprising and just bring down a government. And they've done this like 8-9 times. They did this 2 years ago. Like the army like sent units out to stop them, and they like captured the army units, disarmed them, and forced them to carry the coffins of the people they killed back to the capital. Like that, you know, is the solution to this. Like, that is power.
Mm-hmm.
And Americans don't really, it looks weird to us because we have no real, like, most Americans have never actually had power, right? Have ever actually had the ability to, someone deploys the army against you and you disarm them, right? Of the ability to, when, you know, like when a mining company hurts you, when, like, when your community is under attack, to just shut down a country. And to force the people who think that they have power to sort of, you know, to do things that make sure they don't harm you. And that's the only real way out of this. And this is not just for Asian Americans. That, like, this is the only way out for sort of, like, all of the people who've been just devastated by colonial violence, for Black people, for Indigenous people, is, you know, the representation isn't going to save us. You actually need power.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's terrifying, especially for a lot of white people, because, you know, in some sense, white people have had power, right? Like, you know, and there's obviously varying levels of this, but, you know, if you're going to actually deal with this, you have to smash the systems that cause it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that requires power, like, you know, in terms of dealing with the police, in terms of dealing with ICE, in terms of dealing with the border, in terms of, you know, dealing with the evangelical movement that's producing these killers, right? You need power and you need some way to build it. And there's no easy way to get there, but that's what needs to be done.
And I'll just say, like, the religious right has been doing this very effectively for the last 30 years with their grassroots movements, you know, based off of Phil Schlafly's, you know, fundraising and mailing model. Like, they've got it down, and the left really just hasn't figured it out yet.
No, in part because the left can't stop fighting over, I don't know, whether or not the real problem with the Atlanta shooting is that people are calling the Chinese government out for what's being done to the Uyghurs or whatever. Like, there's these, everything is so atomized, it's impossible to actually build power. Not impossible, but it's not being done effectively right now, you know?
Well, I could say, you know, last year we had one moment.
We did.
We burned down the police, we burned down multiple police stations. Like, I remember.
Great. We should do it again.
Yeah, you know, like, I
in Minecraft.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, I remember when the police, like, lost control of Michigan Avenue in Chicago. Yeah. Like, they just couldn't hold it, and you know, like that can happen. Like, that's a thing that we did. Yeah,
there's, and I mean, that's part of why we're getting very off topic here, but it's part of why there is a concerted effort to not remember last year that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because what last year was a large chunk of the population proving that if enough people get on the same page about two or three things, there is nothing that the military and the police can do. Or at least not that they're able to do. There's nothing the police can do and the military largely won't. But that's not a thing that everyone who is an elected leader has a vested interest in us not remembering.
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, and this is going back to the history books don't talk about the ways it's been successful, and kids are kept in the dark because we're not given the tools to dismantle the master's house.
Yep.
Yeah.
I want to plug two books here real fast about purity culture stuff, if that's okay.
Yeah,
of course.
If you want to go the other route of, you know, decolonizing your mind, I think that Jessica Valenti's The Purity Myth is excellent for a start on this and talking about how virginity is fake and doesn't exist and all those things. And I think a good, you know, pairing with that would be Angela Chen's Ace. It just came out this last year, and it's about asexuality and kind of like really breaking down the, you know, compulsory heteronormative mindset that we grew up in.
Awesome. Thank you.
Well, all right, Christopher, you got anything you want to plug before we roll out today and hopefully don't, yeah, have a, I don't know. How you doing, man?
Yeah,
I know this has been a rough few weeks for you.
Yeah, it's been bad. If you want to see me just completely fall apart on a regular basis, I'm at itmechr3 on Twitter, or the Ice Must Be Destroyed guy. I regularly implode. I swear I do actually update this, and sometimes it's more than once a month, but I have a Substack called The Long 21st Century, where you can also see me implode. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Well, thank you both. And for those of you at home, remember, never laugh at your dad's dick. All right. And that's going to do it for us here at The Worst Year Ever. Bye.
Also, see you later.
I tread. Yes. Daniel.
Lovely.
Worst Year Ever is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.